What's up, Wisconsin? I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. We got two more pairs of Brewers tickets for this coming Tuesday. Brewers are playing the Braves at home at AmFam Field. We've got two pairs of tickets to give away. We're going to get to that just as soon as we can this hour. But up next, one of my favorite guests, president of the Wisconsin Policy Forum, Rob Henken. Welcome back, Rob.
Thank you, Maggie. And I need to correct you. I'm now the immediate past president of the Wisconsin Policy.
Every time you come on, Rob, I get to announce a new title for Rob, immediate past president of the Wisconsin Policy Forum. I also want to begin by giving you a heartfelt congratulations, Rob. You were one of the finalists for Milwaukee's Biz Times Nonprofit Chief Executive of the Year. Congratulations, Rob. An honor well-deserved.
Thank you so much.
Today, we're going to talk a little bit about something that I think, when I read the report, incredibly fascinating. Sales tax revenue across the state has kind of been all over the board, perhaps even somewhat counterintuitively. The Wisconsin Policy Forum just put out a report this month. Tell folks, just top line, what's going on with sales tax revenue statewide?
So, Maggie, clearly nothing at all to panic about. But, interestingly for us government finance geeks, when we think about how harmful inflation has been to consumers, to families, et cetera, particularly when it was particularly high, it's obviously come down quite a bit. One of the only silver linings was that as people had to spend more on their purchases, it meant increased sales tax collections for the state, which has a 5% sales tax, and for counties, which are allowed to implement a 0.5-cent sales tax. And 68 of Wisconsin's 72 counties have done that. So the combination of both inflation and then as we emerge from the pandemic, people with lots of pent-up purchasing, and that exploded, meant very healthy sales tax revenues for the state and for counties. That growth has now slowed. And in part, that was inevitable because inflation has indeed come down. So if prices are only increasing by 3% annually instead of 9 or 10% annually, that's going to make a difference. And on the whole, that's certainly a net positive. But also, it looks like, the economy is slowing down, or at least the types of purchases that produce sales taxes have slowed. So in a nutshell, what we found over the first 5 months of 2024, 0.4% increase in sales taxes at the state level compared to the same 5 months in 2023. But in three of those 5 months, actually a decline from 23 to 24. And so from a government finance perspective, the beginning of maybe some warning signs.
What does this mean for especially municipal, local governments overall in the state?
So there's not as big an impact on municipal governments because so few of them are able to actually levy sales taxes. So we have a small group of municipalities, several in Door County that are deemed premier resort areas. They can do a municipal sales tax. And then, of course, last summer, the state authorized the city of Milwaukee to adopt a 2% city sales tax, which happened in January. And so it's really interesting because this is the first year in which the city has been collecting this sales tax. It is a huge source of revenue for them. They budgeted $184 million. And that in many respects was a stab in the dark because we have good history right on what the sales tax has generated for the county as a whole, but breaking that down for just the city was a little bit of a guessing game. Fortunately, city leaders were rather conservative. So I don't think that the amount coming in certainly is what maybe they had really hoped for, but based on what they budgeted, it looks like there's a reasonable chance that the city at least is going to make budget in 2024.
That was, you're anticipating my next question, Rob, and getting at it a bit. And that is, when we look at these kinds of revenue fluctuations, whether we're talking about for state or municipal government, how accurate are the projections? Because government budgeting is always based on a projection of both costs and revenues over their fiscal year. The state has a biennial budget. Most municipalities are operating on an annual budget basis. So how accurate are predictions around these kinds of revenues? And frankly, how accurate should taxpayers expect those projections to be?
So it depends on the government. And again, at the Wisconsin Policy Forum, not to geek out here for you and your audience, but it's one of the things we look at carefully. When we analyze a budget, we like to be able to understand the assumptions behind key revenue sources. As you would know, because your dad played such a huge role, City of Milwaukee has some really stringent and very fiscally responsible procedures whereby it's not just up to the mayor and his budget director to forecast their revenues. Those have to be certified by the comptroller, who is an independently elected official. And a similar process is the case at Milwaukee County. And so, but again, even government finance professionals with no political interest in either forecasting, you know, on the conservative side or the less conservative side, even they, there's a little bit of guesswork here. And the responsible way to do it is to take a look at past trends, to look at economic forecasts from reputable sources at the national level and at the state level, and to try to, if you can, be a little bit conservative, because you'd rather undershoot than overshoot in terms of putting together your budget. But we have seen times, and before there was an elected comptroller at the county, there were certainly some budgets where, hey, getting down to the last few million dollars to make the budget balance is tough. Let's just jack up our sales tax projection and hope for the best.
For a taxpayer, whether you're in a large jurisdiction or a small one, Rob, Where are the taxpayer, a resident, a voter, where's a good place to go to get a sense of how reasonable, how conservative, how frankly prudent budget projections, especially on the revenue side, are for a particular jurisdiction?
So at the state level, The State Legislative Fiscal Bureau, and it's a really, really dense report, but they produce a voluminous report on the state budget within a month to 6 weeks of its proposal by the governor. And they put out a paper that actually has a very nice narrative about state revenue projections and the basis for them. And LFB will opine, you know, hey, we don't agree with this, or here's where we would be really cautionary about this. So that's a really nice thing. And a lot of people take for granted the Legislative Fiscal Bureau and the role it plays in Wisconsin. And it's a real model for good government. At the municipal and county level, it depends. And again, it's, you know, we at the Wisconsin Policy Forum think that the way you present your budget and the narratives, you should take time, you should take sufficient time to make sure you're explaining things like this to the general public. Many, many municipal and county budgets, they just have that number in there. They have no explanation as to where it came from. Milwaukee County does have a description in its budget. It's one of the better ones we've seen. Arguably, bigger governments with bigger staffs are going to have more capacity to do things like that.
Makes sense, Rob. And this is one of the things that when I talk to voters and people that are concerned about particular issues, and I certainly have always considered myself when I worked in government to be, in effect, a fiduciary of a taxpayer dollar, that I owed taxpayers and residents incredible accountability about how their tax dollars were being spent. My watchword and guide to folks is, if you read something and you don't understand it, it is perfectly reasonable to call the department, to call the elected official, to call, if it's on the legislative side, your representative and say, I don't understand this. Do you understand this? Someone explain this to me. Where did the assumptions come from? Because that is the point at which government, especially as it pertains to spending, is most accountable. When you ask people to explain sometimes complicated stuff, But if they put it in their budget, they should be able to explain it to you. And you're gosh darn well within your rights to ask those kinds of questions. I certainly did. I ran a public retirement plan. You'd have the fancy investment managers come in, all kinds of assumptions built in. And I would always encourage our fiduciary board members and I myself, anytime I heard lingo or something that I couldn't gut check with common sense or my experience, I was asking those questions. I encourage everybody to do just that. Now, Rob, you've been with the Wisconsin Policy Forum, you were with Milwaukee County before for quite some time. We have just been in a period of incredible political upheaval over the last month. We've been joking that sometimes decades seem to go by in weeks. It has seemed that decades have gone by in sometimes days, if not hours. When we come back after taking care of some business, Rob, I want to get your sense, having been a trusted nonpartisan advisor within government and then outside of government, taking a look at all of this, what your sense of this is, especially now with your newer title as the immediate past president of the Wisconsin Policy Forum. He's my very special guest this half hour. As I just explained, the immediate past president of the Wisconsin Policy Forum, Rob Henken. Folks, I'm going to give you your next trivia question for a pair of Brewers tickets. First one in will win. Here's your trivia question, 855-75-CIVIC, 855-752-4842 for a pair of tickets to Tuesday's Brewers-Braves game. In what year did the Brewers begin to play in the National League? They were in the AL for years and years. What year was the first year that the Brewers were in the National League? Get your answers in, 855-75-CIVIC, 855-752-4842. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. Back in just a moment. Back, Wisconsin. And happy Friday, everybody. Sun is shining here in southeastern Wisconsin. We're broadcasting live from downtown Waukesha. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. My special guest this half hour, immediate past president of the Wisconsin Policy Forum, Rob Henken. Congratulations to Dennis, who has taken down the second pair of Brewers baseball tickets, club level tickets for next Tuesday's game against the Braves. Stay tuned, everybody. We got one more pair to give away as we roll into the weekend. You don't want to miss it. Rob, say that again, Brian. I'm sorry.
We do not. We just gave away the last pair just now.
Oh, that is that the, last pair. Okay.
But congratulations. Thanks, you guys are going to have a great time.
You are. The tickets are beautiful. Enjoy Dennis and our earlier winner. Rob, you've been leading the policy forum for 16 years. You worked in county government before that. You've seen a lot, and even more has seemingly transpired in the last couple of weeks. What, as you look back on your time, and I'm going to call it time in public service. Yes, the policy forum is a nonprofit private organization, but it's really in service to the public and to government actors and elected officials to help them make better decisions. As you look back, Rob, what stands out in your time as leader of the Wisconsin Policy Forum, and frankly, as just another voter in person, what do you make of all of the developments over the last couple of weeks?
Yep. Well, so maybe starting on the local level, I think one of the things that certainly stands out for me is sort of the sea change in terms of how city government and county government in Milwaukee relate with one another. So when I started in county government in 1998, John Norquist was the mayor and Tom Ament was the county executive. And the two of them did not get along well. And people at the city and people at the county really didn't like each other. And there wasn't much collaboration and communication. And then Scott Walker became county executive and Tom Barrett became mayor. And we all know that those two gentlemen were political opponents and did not get along. And it was not good. And furthermore, the relationship between the county executive and the board was just terrible. And I'm saying this on a completely nonpartisan basis. I'm not trying to ascribe any blame, but the community suffers when our chief elected officials can't work with one another. And so within county government, we had that. And then we had, a lot of antipathy between the city and the county. We thought it would improve when Chris Abele became county executive, but it didn't. And again, I'm not going to get into all of the reasons for that and who is to blame. But, given that he was known as a Democrat, very disappointing that both that the city-county relationship didn't improve much, and certainly, if anything, the county board versus county executive situation was worse. Well, today, it's just such a breath of fresh air that we have a mayor and a county executive who like each other, grew up together, respect each other, and have said to their staffs, we should be working together. So I think that's a huge positive improvement. Looking back over these 16 years, one of the things that I am now most worried about is I was seeing improvement in terms of schools and K-12 and the warfare between the various education sectors. There was a thawing for a little bit of time there, and it's now just as bad as it ever was. It's a mess, and that's not good for our community. And finally, I know long answer to your question, Maggie, I just do want to reassure people, while I have turned over the keys to a new president of the Wisconsin Policy Forum, Jason Stein, who is our very able vice president, I am still on a half-time basis with the forum, and we'll still be playing a big role in our Milwaukee area research. Just won't be running the place.
I'm certainly glad to hear that, Rob. I think, your summary from an objective basis is incredibly apt. I would just add that the dynamic of the long simmering tension between the city and the county executive and the county board, and then adding on the tension between the region, if you will, and the governor's mansion for a long time. The takeaway for all of this is, to me, Rob, not about the parties, because we had a Democratic mayor and a Democratic county executive. They didn't get along. We had a more Democratic county executive who was sort of centrist, was able to work sometimes with a completely Republican-controlled state government. This isn't really about party. This is my comments, not Mr. Henkins. To me, a lot of this comes down to, frankly, ego and the willingness of elected officials to place ego and personality aside to try to forge what sometimes can be very difficult middle ground. And to find those places where compromise and cooperation are possible. And I think we're seeing that even with the hyperpartisan nature of what I'm going to call the rhetoric, even within state and local governments, we've been able to see some points of compromise that have happened that have been absolutely essential. It's quite remarkable that this is happening in this moment, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. And I would actually then seg that into the rest of your question on what's happening nationally.
Yes.
And, all of my years working in and around government, which is now 30 years, one of the things I have seen so often is elected officials who have been there for a while and their personal grievances, their personal animosities, which are very well justified. People have been rotten to them in many legitimate cases, but those start to supersede the reasons why they got into office. And so, and that goes, I've just seen it for so many people I've admired. So number one, let's hope we have two very young leaders in our community. Let's hope that that doesn't happen with them. And it's sort of, you know, what's happening on the national level. And it's not that, again, I don't think President Biden, it wasn't the grievances, but clearly the question could have been asked, is it just time to step aside? And we all know our other presidential candidate certainly has lots of grievances. So I'll leave it at that.
Fair enough, Rob. That's my very special guest, immediate past president of the Wisconsin Policy Forum, Rob Henken. I'll double down on that. Whenever I hear elected officials devolve into personal attacks, personal animosities, and leaning towards score settling or tit for tat, that's when you know government has broken down. It doesn't serve any of us well. No matter what initial you put behind your name or no initial at all, that is not a good harbinger of things to come. Thanks so much, Rob, for joining us. I'm Maggie Dawn, folks. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. We'll be back with another very special guest, State Assembly candidate for the 11th District, Amelia Heredia. Stay tuned, folks. We'll be back in just a moment.
If I can take on 100,000 protesters, I can do the same across the world.
Happy Friday, Wisconsin. I hope y'all are doing well this afternoon. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. I'm really excited to introduce my next guest. She and I met at a Milwaukee County board meeting. Was it March?
That was like 4 years ago.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, which feels like 4 years ago, as Fancy Brian was just saying. We met back in March at a Milwaukee County board meeting. She was emceeing the Women's History Month festivities that day. I was blown away by how incredibly well you handled all of the big personalities in that room and kept that celebration moving right along. She is an accomplished woman. Her name is Amelia Heredia. She is running for the State Assembly District 11. New to the political game, welcome to the circus, Amelia. Thanks for making time for all of us. I think, Amelia, you might be muted or frozen. And are you still getting me, Brian? I just want to make sure you can hear me all right.
I am indeed. You sound fantastic. I really like hearing from you.
Well, good. I'll continue to say wonderful things.
I believe we have
things.
Amelia back now, though.
Okay, super. Hi, Amelia. Thanks for making time. First,
okay. What, can you hear me? I'm so sorry about that.
That's quite all right. We can hear you just fine. You are a graduate student currently at UWM. You already have 2 degrees from UWM. You're a grassroots activist. You've volunteered at CASA. You're really focused on child advocacy. Why did you decide to throw your hat into the political ring?
Yeah, so that's a good question. Thank you for that. I, for the last 7 years, have been in student government, worked my way up from a committee member to a senator, then on the executive board, and then I became president, and I did that for 2 years. And I was really passionate about the role, and coming out of that role and doing that transition, I realized I want to do this for the rest of my life, advocating for the, you know, the minority per se, right? Students are the minority in this case. And just advocating and representing for different minority groups on campus really lit a fire under me. And I wanted to bring that passion to the greater Milwaukee area. So a couple of trainings later, Ignite, Run for Something, and here I am.
Well, I'm
throwing my hat into the race.
Yes, I'm certainly happy to see you making this a competitive primary for the 9th district. Tell me why you, if folks live in the 11th district, why you right now as opposed to your opponent? What sets you apart in this race?
When I'm not, thank you for asking that, getting that question a lot. When I'm knocking doors, folks are telling me that they are feeling really disenfranchised when it comes to elected officials, when it comes to politics, when it comes to being represented. I have a passion, being a grassroots activist, bringing people to the table, not being at the table unless my people, my community are there. And I'm bringing that into this position. I want to collaborate with government bodies across the board. I want to make sure that when I am making legislative decisions and when I'm starting projects, that I am reaching out to stakeholders, nonprofit organizations, community leaders, and members to ask for their feedback, to ask for directions. Am I doing this right? Am I representing you accurately? Some folks are feeling that folks just run to get into the seats and then disappear. And a lot of folks, you know, on the doors are asking, are you going to stay present? Are you going to be in community with us? And to that, I always say, you are stuck with me. I am going to be here. I'm going to be present. And I'm going to continue to advocate on your behalf with you by my side, you know, not behind closed doors. So, yeah.
It's brave and bold. Your opponent has been running for offices for quite some time, has some name recognition. How are you countering that? What's the strategy to get your name out to folks and to increase awareness about your advocacy platform?
It's really important to just stay in community with folks, right? Having those tough conversations. There are a lot of folks that I've talked to who don't feel comfortable, who don't feel uplifted to vote. Why is that? What are you feeling in this political climate with the societal pressures that you're going through? And really being on the ground, grassroots, going to the community meetings that are happening right now, going to the community events, showing up at spaces that aren't just a bunch of other elected officials, right? Like being on the ground with folks and being immersed into the community and staying there, right? Not doing that to just collect signatures, not doing that just because I'm campaigning, but doing that because I'm creating these lifelong relationships with people on these doors. And following back up has been really crucial, right? Like, hey, you signed my signature sheet. I appreciate that. Or you didn't, and that's okay. But I have it down that I knocked your door. Would you like to come to my birthday fundraiser? Well, what do you think about this project that I would like to start in the community? And having those conversations has been vital to my campaign. I simply couldn't do it without everyone.
Finally, and perhaps most importantly, Amelia, what are your campaign platforms? What are the policies that you want to get accomplished? Before you answer that question, let me just reintroduce you. Folks, if you're just joining us, my special guest this half hour is Amelia Heredia. She is running for the State Assembly District 11. She's new to the political game. What do you want to get accomplished if you get elected?
Yeah, so my campaign, my platform is holistic child-focused advocacy. And when I say holistic, I really want to double down on that. So thinking about if a child doesn't have food, a child doesn't have housing, well, then their parents, their grandparents, their aunts, their uncles, their big sisters, their big brothers also don't have that. So let's talk about the different resources that they have access to provide help for everyone. It takes a village. We keep hearing that in the community. But why aren't we supporting that same village that it takes to make sure that that child has all the resources and opportunity that they need? And so that informs my 4 campaign intentions outside of my personal experiences, because I can speak to all 4 of my campaign intentions. I want to expand children's access to food, housing, and education. education, right? So thinking about the IEP structure in schools and strengthening that, getting teachers and staff the pay that they deserve and the support that they deserve, thinking about Badger Care, thinking about, you know, affordable housing, expanding that. Let's ask those hard questions. Who gets to write the caps for these, and why can't we change them? Why is it just, oh, that's always the way that it is, right? The second, I want to enact in transformative justice, thinking about the different resources that we have in our correctional facilities, right? Wanting to make sure that folks have the opportunities to rehabilitate and come out of a correctional facility and integrate back into society with a skill set that they might have been missing before they were justice impacted. Thinking about the different resources we have in the community once they get back to us, right? Are there enough? And there's not. I'll answer my own question here. There's not. Thinking about reentry programs, thinking about the different ways that we can support folks that is innovative, that we don't think about, right? The third thing is expanding healthcare access. And of course, we're hearing this a lot with abortion care and bodily autonomy being on, you know, one of the bigger things on the ticket this, you know, voting season, this political season, but really thinking about mental health care access in Milwaukee too, thinking about all the different folks that we are seeing, you know, newly diagnosed or struggling, not having access to that psychiatrist or that therapist that they need, and insurance, right? Maybe they have that access, but maybe they're coming out of $400 every 2 weeks because of that. So thinking about that, why, you know, statewide, and what we can do about that. Are there different alternatives? You know, thinking innovatively about it. And last but not least, definitely not least, is strengthening the infrastructure of the foster care system. We have got kids in the foster care system that are unfortunately going to age out because they're deemed, for lack of a better way of saying it, as undesirable. Maybe they have behavioral issues. Maybe they are a part of a sibling group. Maybe they have disabilities. How do we uplift and give these folks a stable home so that when they turn 18, they have that skill set that they need to be successful in life? How are we helping these foster care families that are graceful enough to be taking these kiddos in, and whether it be fostering or adopting, do they have the trainings that they need? Do they have the resources that they need? And last but not least, are we doing the checks and the balances that we need to make sure that the foster care families that we have in place are ready to accept all and every kiddo that comes to the door, whether they have disabilities, whether they are trans, whether they have behavioral issues? Are we simply leaving kids in limbo because we're not giving the resources that the foster care families need? I've experienced disenfranchisement from the lack of policies and innovative opportunities and problem solving around all four of these intentions. And that is why they are my campaign intentions. Because I know if I went through it and I have a lot of privilege and I, you know, fortunately got through it, there are other folks that have not been so lucky. So I want to uplift those folks. I hear them and I see them. But of course, those aren't the four things that I'm passionate about, and you can only fit so much on a flyer. And so also making sure that I'm asking those questions at the doors. What do you need, you know, in the, what do you want in the neighborhood? What do you want in the community? What do you want in the state? And writing those answers down and uplifting them to other elected officials and keeping them in mind when I'm knocking doors and when I get elected, so that folks don't feel like I'm just my own echo chamber and just doing what it is that I want to do. So yeah, I know that was a very lengthy answer, but I'm very passionate about these things.
Your four pillars, just to summarize, to be sure that everybody caught them: expanding children's access to housing, food, and education, working to forward transformative justice, increasing access to healthcare, and improving the foster care system. My special guest this half hour, Amelia Herrera. Heredia, excuse me, and apologies for getting your name wrong, a State Assembly District 11 candidate. You're going to see her, if you're in the 11th District, on the primary ballot on August 13th. I would be remiss if I did not ask you, as a Black woman, what is your feeling when you heard that Vice President Harris is going to be the Democratic nominee for president?
Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you for asking this question. I have been waiting to get this question. I'm excited. There's a Black woman that's going to be it was one thing to run for state assembly, but you know, now there's representation all the way up. And thinking about educating folks on her grand her political rap sheet, for lack of a better way of saying it, and having those tough conversations, this is kind of not unprecedented, but it's new, and it'll push our country forward in a way that we have not seen just yet. So I'm excited.
I am too. I share in that enthusiasm. I would call myself joyful about it. It brought an incredible emotional lift for me, and I'm so happy and pleased to hear that it brought you some joy and some excitement as well. Again, Amelia, all my best for your candidacy coming up on the August 13th ballot, folks. If you are in District 11 for the State Assembly, you're going to see Amelia Heredia on your ballot. Check her out. Where can they find out more about you, Amelia?
Yeah, so there's going to be three different places. Well, three places and one place I'm going to suggest you go, right? So there's going to be my website. It is Amelia for Assembly, AMILLIA for Assembly.com. You can also follow me on Facebook, Amelia for District 11 State Assembly. I am posting on there. I'll be posting about this on there, and my door knocking and the different conversations that I'm having with community stakeholders as well. And please, if you have any questions, concerns, suggestions, reach out to me at my email, AmeliaForAssembly@gmail.com. I would love to get coffee with you and chat about your different aspirations.
That is called an accessible candidate, folks. Thanks so much, Amelia. Best of luck on August 13th. Folks, stick around. I'm going to have some final thoughts for a week. Might even listen to some more crazy things that J.D. Vance has said. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network.
Good luck. We're all counting on you.
Wisconsin. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. Wow, this week has flown by. In fact, last 3 weeks have flown by. So much going on. Of course, we now have J.D. Vance as Donald Trump's vice presidential candidate. And I don't think Trump is happy. He listened to Tweedledee and Tweedledum, his two sons, and tossed out what is reported to be his previous pick. It is now reported that Donald Trump was going to go with Governor Doug Burgum. And based upon urging by Tucker Carlson, as well as his sons, Eric and Don Jr., he dumped Burgum for the bearded lady, also known as J.D. Vance. It is somewhat of a clown show, also creating a problem, not just J.D. Vance's extreme abortion stance, co-authoring a national ban at 15 weeks. Some of the flip-flopping that J.D. Vance has done that frankly is his political brand. J.D. Vance, the bearded lady flip-flopper, is who this guy is. But now reporting that J.D. Vance has written the introduction to a book by Kevin Roberts, the head of Project 2025. The guy has been the director of the Heritage Foundation. Trump trying to create some space between himself and Project 2025. We all know that's the platform, that's the plan. Now Vance again blowing up in his face, writing the introduction for a book that was first titled Dawn's Early Light, Burning Down Washington to Save America. That's a little problematic. Apparently, they've now changed the title to Taking Back Washington. But again, now Donald Trump filled with tripe, being forever handcuffed to Project 2025, courtesy of the loser VP choice that he's made in J.D. Vance. I call him a loser because he says things like, you know, It's weird. Let's just listen. This is J.D. Vance on Tucker Carlson from 2021 talking about cat ladies.
We're effectively run in this country via the Democrats, via our corporate oligarchs, by a bunch of childless cat ladies who are miserable at their own lives and the choices that they've made. And so they want to make the rest of the country miserable, too. And it's just a basic fact. You look at Kamala Harris, Pete Buttigieg, AOC, the entire future of the Democrats is controlled by people without children. And how does it make any sense that we've turned our country over to people who don't really have a direct stake in it?
I don't know. They seem to be pretty happy to me. Those three specific people seem to be pretty darn happy.
Just a gender check too, JD. Pete's a dude. Not sure if you got that memo. All of the things that are wrong with that are truly, truly obvious. I'll just say this. J.D. Vance, and you can see this regardless of his flip-flopping over the years, J.D. Vance, his worldview is that a woman's value is derived only and exclusively from her function as a mother. That only through having kids does anyone, or a woman especially, have any sort of value. It's absolutely ridiculous. And the fact of the matter is, JD's got, I think, what is it, four kids under the age of 8 or 9? I mean, he's got, how possibly can you be a present and involved father, JD, if you're going to be vice president? You know, why isn't he getting asked all the questions that female candidates with kids get asked by conservatives all the time? J.D. Vance says to women, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. His point, of course, is women just don't count as much as men do. If you had any doubt about it, let's take a listen to what J.D. Vance also had to say in 2021, talking to Charlie Kirk about how to tax people without kids. This is a weird one.
We need to reward the things that we think are good and punish the things that we think are bad. So you talk about tax policy. Let's tax the things that are bad and not tax the things that are good. If you're making $100,000, $400,000 a year, and you've got three kids, you should pay a different lower tax rate than if you're making the same amount of money and you don't have any kids. It's that simple.
Except dear it's just JD, not.
First of all, it's unconstitutional to effectively discriminate people based on family status. But besides that, JD, there's a thing called the child tax credit that works and is supposed to work for people that are middle class and struggling. And did you know, JD, that your party generally opposes the child tax? I mean, he doesn't know what he's talking about, but what he says is so deeply offensive on almost any reasonable level. It's just ridiculous. Let's see here. Oh, to my point about JD, how possibly can you be a working father and a vice president? You know, Madam Vice President, she's gone all over the world in her work. Let's see. Kamala Harris has been to Germany, Ghana, Tanzania, Zambia, the Bahamas, Indonesia, the United Kingdom, and the United Arab Emirates, among other countries. That's just in 2023. How possibly can you be a present father, JD? Let's take a listen to what JD Vance said to Megyn Kelly. This is on July 25th, 2024. Brian, it's the last cut in that list about being a working parent.
And Megyn, this comment that I made was actually motivated in part by a conversation I had with my wife, where, you know, she at the time had two babies. We hadn't yet had a third. And she was talking about how she felt this incredible professional pressure to not have kids because it set back her professional advancement. And what a weird society that we've set up where moms who want to work, the thought that a lot of them are having is, I can't have more babies because it's going to be bad for my career. How about we make the workplace more accommodating to working moms and working dads so that we can promote a real culture of life?
Wow.
Well, JD, gee whiz, did you stumble upon a little nugget of wisdom there? So you support both mom and paternal family leave, paid leave, and expansion of childcare? Oh my goodness, JD, you sound like a liberal. Again, the guy doesn't know what he believes, and all that ends up coming out of his mouth is whatever he thinks in the moment will serve JD the most. an opportunistic, shape-shifting snake oil salesman for a vice presidential candidate for a shape-shifting snake oil salesman, opportunistic presidential candidate from the GOP. Birds of a feather certainly sticking together. That's going to do it for me, folks. Got a little bit of a vacation coming up. You're going to have great guest hosts. They'll be seeing you on Monday. I'll be back, though. Don't you worry, folks. That's going to do it for us. Have a wonderful weekend, everybody. Remember, I'll stand up for you. I hope you stand up for me, but it is always better when we stand.